This episode of Yes But Why podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah.
I'll preface this by saying both my parents are actors, and I'm actually third generation show business family.
Wow.
So I was acting as a baby before I knew what was going on. I was in commercials and stuff and photo shoots. But the memory that I have that's the most solid, even though it's a memory of failure, it kept me on the path, was I think I was about 7 or so. I was 7 or 8 years old, and I tended to do a lot of commercials, and we were talking a little bit about age, but let's just say I was a kid. I'm Generation X, so I was a kid during the 1970s. Uh-huh. And the look that I had, and kind of sort of still do, was like the low rent Jodie Foster, Tatum O'Neill. So that's kind of what I was cast as, and various things, but like the affordable kid that looked like those two stars.
Nice.
And I went to a commercial audition for, I don't know, real estate or something, and they wanted me to wear a dress. And I'm queer now, and I was actually extremely aware of my differences in potential butchitude and queerness as a kid. Hmm. And I didn't like wearing dresses, and I didn't want to wear a dress for that commercial. And I had a huge tantrum, and I hid under a table in the studios, and my mom couldn't be on set that day, but my aunt Annie was there, and my cousin Daniel, who's exactly my age, and we had the exact same like 1970s blonde bowl haircut going on. They just happened to be my guardians that they were hanging around, and I had a fit. So the director's like, "Who's that kid? That kid looks like her." It's like, "It's my cousin Dan." I'm like, "Well, put him in a dress and get him in front of the cameras." And so he got the commercial.
In the dress, no less.
In the dress. Yeah, he didn't care. He's a super mellow dude. And so now he's actually a very successful director of photography, cinematographer, camera guy, director in New York. Not traumatized at all, you know, married, couple kids, all that, you know. But he was mellow enough to be like, okay.
Seems like that director of that commercial didn't care who was in it as long as somebody was in that dress. The dress
somebody
was the key.
Someone who kind of had that age and that look needed to be in that dress and hold their fake parent's hand and look at the house in the real estate commercial. That's all that had to happen. That's it. And I blew it. I completely blew it. And that was pretty much the end of, you know, acting on camera as a kid. And I refocused into music. By then I was playing piano, and I soon added a bunch of other instruments. And I ended up doing a mix of theater, drama, and music throughout middle school and high school. And then in college, really just primarily focused on music. And it really came down to, you know, that incident. And there was other acting that I did as a kid that I remember that was, you know, perfectly fun and fine. Or visiting the set of what, you know, my grandfather or what my parents were working on. That was fun and fine. But that really solidified in me that I'm not just going to have a tantrum. I'm actually going to have boundaries throughout my career of what I want to do and what I'm willing to do and how I'm willing to look. And it started from a really young age.
Yeah. That's probably important to know in a performer family for sure, because there's a lot of like, just wear what we tell you in the performing world.
Yeah. And also growing up that way, I mean, advantages and disadvantages, but an interesting thing was, having like yourself, as you mentioned, I've been through a lot of different creative scenes, and I've had various amounts of success or failures in each of them. And I also knew from that young age that not to just chase fame, that if I'm doing something creatively, it's because I love doing it and or I'm talented at it and it's you know, creating some great pieces. And it mattered less for my happiness of whether I was famous or not in that thing. As long as I was felt like I was doing good work and I was respected by my peers, that was important because I grew up surrounded by, you know, people would come over for dinner and half of them would be really, really well-known celebrities and the other half would be the normal people that are in show business. And, you know, they were equally happy or equally miserable. So fame or riches had almost nothing to do with that, whether they were a nice person or not. And I think that was a really important lesson to get early on, to move through creativity and the arts and my own journey in that without feeling maybe some other internal pressures or having some sort of twisted fairy tale vision of what it would be like if I achieved, you know, fame at a household name.
Yeah, you certainly kind of glad had a realistic view based on the right people that were around you, for sure.
Right.
Huh.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it almost would seem interesting that you continued to do it. I mean, you saw how tough it was. You saw sort of the, you know, insanity that there could be, but you still decided to get involved. You mentioned that you did plays in school, but then later on you got involved in music. Is that music like you're in a band or music like you're in a symphony or music like you got a ukulele on the street corner? A lot of options.
Yes, and all of it. Nice. So I play at this point in my life, Gen X life, I play without exaggeration, some dozens of musical instruments. And the ones that I studied and played professionally for and have a degree in for jazz studies is that my main instruments are brass and voice. So singing, trumpet, French horn, stuff like that. And I currently play keyboards and sometimes guitar, but I'm better at keyboards, in teaching improv music and singing and doing some private music and singing lessons and some other, in teaching kids and adults other instruments that I play as well, including trumpet. So that's part of what I do. And then I kind of have, you know, day jobby consultancy, work from home stuff that I do as well. But I just kind of kept adding, once I pulled a little bit back from drama through high school and college and after high school and college in my 20s, I wasn't doing as much performing that wasn't behind an instrument or singing. And then in my late 20s, groups of friends that I was running around with, I ended up crossing paths with some comedians that I had really admired over the years. So in my late 20s, some of these comedians ended up becoming my mentors and said, hey, you're really funny. You should get, you know, try stand-up comedy or try improv or try these things. And so that steered me for about 10 years into a stand-up career. And I did stand-up comedy from late 20s and into my 30s and combined that with starting to do improv more. And then that all evolved to a point where knowing how show business works and then seeing the stand-up side of it at that time, late 90s to through mid-2000s, I know enough about show business now and from my upbringing that when I hit a wall of either boredom or toxicity that I don't want to cross is when I kind of switch gears. And that happened about 10 years into stand-up, where I was getting bored with not improvising things as much all the time and having more jokes that are written and done over and over again. And it just was, you know, years prior to Me Too. So horrendous things were happening in the business. And I didn't want to be a part of it. And I didn't want to witness it. And I didn't want to watch my friends go through it. I didn't want to be subject to it. So I was like, okay, I'm actually going to steer away from stand-up and do it. I still do it occasionally, but I'm not going to try to make it as much of a career or go on tour all the time. And I kind of reverted back to music again and improv. And then that has evolved into a pretty even mix of producing, acting, sometimes voiceover work, sometimes music. Now I'm kind of at a point where it's in a nice blend, but most of what I'm doing creatively is music in bands and or improv or musical improv and the performance and production and direction of stuff in that genre.
So you're currently in the Bay Area to do this music and musical improv right now?
Yes, I live in San Francisco, and I do shows primarily with a couple of theater companies in San Francisco, and I have an indie troupe and a few other teams and shows where we tour around with festivals whenever we feel like, you know, getting the road and doing stuff like that. And I have bands and different musician friends that I play shows with or do, I'm on their recordings, I'm on their albums with my instruments.
You mentioned having been through various different scenes like myself, and I wonder now that you're sort of, I'm going to use the word settled, but I don't mean it negatively,
yeah,
in San Francisco with the situations that you're doing right now, do you find it helpful to have the two different scenes, like the people in band scene and the improv scene, as separate scenes so that you can sort of like bounce back and forth and it lets you have a break from each one?
I thought that would be the case, but the funny thing is that at least in the Bay Area, and I think this is true because I still pop down to LA quite a bit as well for that stuff, is they overlap more than you think they would. And it turns out to be just a really, really, really small world. So, you know, a studio composer, you know, friend of my wife's that is in LA ended up helping me get connections, producing an improv festival to like whole other improv bands and other artists. And it just, so it's a strangely small world, but there's definitely times where I get surprised and the other people get surprised when I'm at an improv show and in one or directing one or being the accompanist in one, and you know, some other musician that I know from trumpet playing or French horn playing, you know, turns up to that. But again, maybe the Bay Area, just the culture here of how our arts overlap is a little bit different than larger markets like LA or New York. But it's been fascinating to me, particularly in the last, you know, 20-something years of doing improv, how much it overlaps, how much the improv community overlaps into so many other art scenes.
Are you, have you always been in San Francisco? Was this where you grew up as well?
No, I grew up in Southern California, and my grandfather was actively producing big shows until he retired in the 70s. So we'd be going between L.A. And Orange County. We kind of bopped just along the Southern California coast, and where we were living, we had a short time where we lived with my grandparents in Hawaii, and they were in 1981. So I moved up here to go to college for jazz studies for school at Sonoma State, and I had some other, you know, aunts and uncles that were had already resettled in their various creative careers in the Bay Area as well. So it was just easy to kind of go back and forth. And at this point, my wife and I each have family all up and down the West Coast from San Diego to Vancouver.
Right on. So like you're like, I'm going to use the word settled again. I don't mean it in a negative way.
No, I understand.
I keep like
fine.
Thinking it, and then I'm like, what? I'm thinking about like how, you know, you're in the world that you're at, like you're definitely performing. How do you keep it, you know, how do you survive the burnout? How do you like navigate it as it like ebbs and flows in the like, okay, I'm doing a lot of stuff, I'm overwhelmed, okay, I gotta slow down. What's your process for, you know, keeping an even keel?
I mean, the process is just, if I start to get overwhelmed, I pull back from one or two of the like seven different things that are going on. And just kind of, and I'm kind of at the, particularly at the age and definitely at the experience level, and I think well-known enough in the community where I'm like, hey, I'm taking, you know, I'm stepping back from such and such project for a second. People get it. I haven't felt like I needed to take a really long break since kind of late 2000s. And I very purposely stepped back from going so much into improv around kind of 2007, 2008, which was recession time anyway. I pulled back I'd been freelancing for a few years, and I was like, okay, you know, stuff's getting real out in the economy, and I might need to get, you know, a jobby job with some benefits attached to it. So I pulled back from, you know, completely freelancing and improv and producing and playing and doing voiceover or whatever. And really took a pretty active break, you know, occasionally did shows and favors to friends, but didn't pursue auditioning, didn't try to form teams, to do theater sports or any of the stuff that was kind of going on, didn't drop into any jams. And I took a few years off. I took just about four, not quite 5 years off. And then I reappeared on the scene around 2013 and auditioned for a late night Saturday show at Unscripted Theater, which is one of the main theaters I'm still now attached to, and it's called Dash, late night Saturday show called Dash, which is kind of free form, anything can happen, kind of an improv show, no actual format to it, just short form, but anything could happen. No set list, no nothing. And really loved it and stayed with that group for, gosh, the 5 years that it ran, something like that. It was a pretty successful show. And that kind of got me passionate about the improv scene again, and it had changed enough and there were enough new people in it that it was fun and exciting and interesting again. And since then, I haven't felt that out of balance with it. There's certainly times where I've, you know, been tired, where seasonally projects like producing a festival, like the month before the festival, okay, we're all going to be exhausted and it'll be done and then we can rest for a bit. So I think I've found a balance, knock on wood, that, you know, if something gets too intense or I take on too much, I'm better at saying no to stuff and like, oh, I don't actually have the bandwidth to take this on. And I wasn't even as good at that, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I definitely think that that's a learned skill for sure. Like the idea of being able to acknowledge, like, I need to finish this. I mean, I'm still very bad at it. I do things for far too long. But, you know, at the same time, I'm always like, but there's worth in this. But there's worth in this. But, yeah, I mean, it's getting better. I mean, since I've had a kid, it's really helped me to prioritize. Though realistically, it's not that I'm like amazingly organized now. It's that right now I used to have the bandwidth of like a top of the line computer. And now I have the bandwidth of like the first ever digital camera. So like one photo.
Right.
That's about it.
Yeah.
So I can only go about
2 kilobytes of bandwidth.
That's all I got. That's all I got going. And then I'm like, okay, I'm done. What? Oh, I can't do anything else. Yeah, it's weird, but
I don't have any human children. Yeah, but I get it. Yeah, I don't think I'd be able to if I had human children. Yeah.
Well, your like 5 year break is like making me feel better because I've like currently taken like a 2 year break and I'm like, oh, see, it's fine. Like I'm just creatively like refreshing myself. So essentially, all these interviews are just me trying to make me feel better. Like that's how it all goes.
They should.
That's how I arrange them.
Most people that were either on the scene in the Bay Area when I started, or LA for that matter, when I started doing improv and stand-up, you know, 80% of them either have quit completely in the last 20 years, like they've gone 5 or 10 years into it, gone nope, or, you know, full-time day job or whatever. And I've done full-time day jobs and all this stuff at the same time, so I get it. Or they did the thing where even if they're the artistic director of, you know, a major, major well-known theater school here, they're like, whoop, time out, taking a sabbatical for a couple of years, you know. And again, just knowing, I think a part of it is age and experience. So just knowing that about yourself and hitting a wall and knowing that, you know, giving yourself permission to step back, not just from improv, but, you know, in my case, like I've been in and out of, you know, I've stepped away from music for years and not, you know, played in bands as much or not even practiced my primary instruments very much and then, you know, dusted them off and gotten back into it again. So I've definitely been, you know, shifting between worlds and scenes for most of my life. And it actually took until pretty recently, until getting over this last break in 2013, to not see any of those as failures. Because it was really easy to shame spiral or beat myself up about, you know, I didn't like this enough, or I don't have the passion, or, you know, this feels like I'm in an abusive relationship with this scene. Like, why am I doing this to myself? To be healthy, I have to step back. Maybe I'm not strong enough like everyone else. Maybe I don't have grit. So just all of that weird judgment stuff would go through my mind. And then I got to a point, you know, in the last five-ish, almost 10 years, where one, I don't care what anybody else thinks. I'm here to enjoy myself and do the best kinds of arts in the best kinds of ways that I know how and enjoy it. And I also realize that when I let, that nobody else had that attitude towards me, that when I let go of that stuff, I realized I was the only one telling myself that weird, critical, shame spirally stuff. Everybody else was delighted to have me around and doing whatever I was around and doing with them artistically. And that it took a long time for me to like accept that goodness from the rest of the scene and that support. And not, you know, and understand that like, oh, perhaps I'm actually worthy of people liking what I'm doing and enjoying me teaching them or being in the thing with them or directing them or just playing alongside, like whatever the case may be. I'm like, okay, now I'm just like, I'm really just enjoying it because there isn't any economic pressure that this is my only career and this is the only thing I know how to do and I have nothing to fall back on. It's like, no, my life is in the balance where, you know, I have like a consulting jobby job thing that I do from home on my own time and I have plenty of, you know, what bandwidth that I want to have for the creative things that I'm doing. And those are, you know, bringing in some money, but I'm not frightened that I'm not, you know, making enough or I'm not compromising myself to try to be more commercial in any of these ventures. Like, you know, the internal pressure that can occur in one's, you know, teens or 20s or any time in your career if you're too deep into a scene or too attached to the fame of it.
It's so crazy how, like, when we think of somebody else, like, you're telling me this story, and my brain is just like, no, what? No, you're not a failure. You're just taking time for yourself. But in the same breath, there's a voice in my head that's like,
yep.
Yeah, when you do it, you're crap. Like, oh,
yeah, you couldn't
God.
Cut it. Sis.
Like, yeah, and I'm like, you know, listening with all this like hope for you, and I'm like, oh no, you know what? We can do this till we die. It's all right, you know. And then I'm like, say these things to yourself, like,
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I am so down in the dumps about my own. Like, yeah, you haven't done anything in a while. Like, do you even know how to do it? Like all these kinds of like thoughts in my head. And then, you know, it's so funny. It's like, I hear you talking about, it's just funny how we like, you know, want to help other people, yeah. But we're so negative to ourselves.
We're really hard on ourselves. And then you think about like, if I had remained purely in the music scene and gone on to be more of, or a full-time, you know, studio session player on trumpet or French horn or any of those things. Like if I had gone in that direction specifically, then what you see in the music scene is that particularly very, very famous artists, and people can still get away with it even in the wacky machine of downloads and self-production that's going on now. But, you know, Hozier took 10 years for his second album and everyone was delighted that he had a second album. And nobody cared that it was 10 years from his first hit album. Robbie Robertson of The Band, hugely famous in the 70s, did a bunch of stuff in the 70s. He also took, I think, 15 years, 10, at least 10 or 15 years, and he didn't release an album of his own until, I think, 88 or 89. So at least 10 years beyond the stuff that he'd done. And that happens in the music industry all the time. Somebody's like, well, you know, how long have we waited for that Axl Rose Guns N' Roses follow-up album? I mean, it may suck, but like, you know, decades go by and nobody blinks. There might be a little criticism if they're super duper famous of like, when is this happening? Or, you know, if a record company is expecting a contract fulfillment in X amount of time. But I think it depends on which scene you're in and what kind of weird false internal pressures and then what actual external pressures exist. And I'm here to tell you that there's probably no such thing as an external pressure in improv to do stuff like that, since we're not selling hit records. We're not making a ton of money for somebody else, you know, in a parallel creative industry. So, you know, take the time you need. And people, in my case, I've done it with my friends, they've done it with me. I've seen it dozens of times where you just get welcomed back into the community when you're welcome to come back, or you pivot into something slightly different, and then you're in that scene. But yeah, we're so much harder on ourselves. It's ridiculous. It's silly.
So let's take a little walk back for a second. We're talking a lot about right now and what's going on, which I think is like super valid, but I'd love to know how you got into improv. You had been experienced in, you know, doing commercials, you were doing theater, your whole family is involved in theater and film, like you're in it. How did you get improv out of it? Was improv your refuge from stand-up?
Not directly, but closely related. So a comedian that I hear, okay, here's a funny story. So around 1996 or so, for absolute goofy fun, I was heavily involved in the Xena fandom, heavily involved. I showed up to conventions in costumes. I had a martial arts thing that I did with another martial artist friend of mine, and we had a fight routine workout in our Amazon costumes, and we'd go entertain at conventions. We organized the first San Francisco Pride Xena contingent. We did all this goofy stuff that was on in the queer Xena scene of the Bay Area and beyond.
That's awesome.
And because of that, I got invited, and this is when I was still kind of mainly musicianing, but I was definitely at a point where I was thinking, like, oh, I want to do something different. I'm getting burned out. It's weird and sexist, and it's gross, and I'm bored with it. Bored with playing the same kinds of songs over and over again. And through my Xena stuff, I got invited to do a segment on a local hit radio station, it's Live 105, and it's something called the Alex Bennett Show. And he's not a DJ in the Bay Area anymore. I think he's in Texas. But I got a segment talking, basically reviewing Xena the morning after the show was on. And I was on this radio station for five or six weeks doing this segment. And on one of the first segments, one of the lead-ins was an interview with a comedian that wasn't a household name, but is, you know, working all the time and great comedic actor and dramatic actor. And I loved his work. And I was such a comedy dork and such an inside show business dork of knowing people who weren't otherwise famous that I kind of fangirled a little bit. And I was like, you know what? I really admire your work. And I think you're so smart and you're so interesting. And you're so funny. And, you know, I'm just showing up to some radio station somewhere in Amazon costume talking about a TV show I love, but I really love what you do. And his name is Rick Overton. And Rick became my buddy. He became my friend. He's well known as a great improviser in that scene. He's well respected as, you know, an actor and comedian and writer, and just never quite broke through like his and our friend Robin Williams, just never quite broke through to that super fame. But still, you know, working. I talk to Rick all the time, see him as often as I can, which isn't as often as I want. But, you know, we're still around each other. And he really helped me get some core ideas and strategies around doing my stand-up and being interested in improv. So I started kind of taking improv classes, and I didn't take any stand-up classes. I just started taking improv classes, mainly at BATS, Bay Area Theater Sports, and also a theater called Improv Works, and I did some private classes. And I would bop down to L.A. and do some stand-up and then guest with Rick's improv groups, whether they were at, you know, Comedy Store, wherever they were playing, I would drop in and do that, or if we were up at the Punchline. So I was kind of hitting these clubs as a stand-up, and then I was hanging around and doing improv with people, and got about, you know, 10-ish years into doing stand-up and watched some friends get very, very famous. I watched some friends get close to being very famous and then fall apart. I watched other friends not get very famous, but, you know, work about as hard as I did and then decide to give up before I decided to give up, like, you know, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years into it and do something completely different or settle down and have kids and family, whatever the case may be. And then I just got to the point where I felt like I wasn't going to make progress. No one was going to offer me a pilot. Like, I wasn't going to have a big breakthrough. And it was becoming much more interesting for me, and I was getting many more opportunities to do more theater production and improv stuff in general. So that kind of led to stepping away from stand-up, or at least stepping away from booking tours. And so the last tour I did as a stand-up was, I think, spring of 2007. So it was about a 10-year run. And then I'm like, okay, that was kind of a miserable tour experience, even though people liked me at the gigs. I just realized road life sucks. I don't like being in weird motels and new places all the time. I don't like flying. I don't like being in vans with a bunch of people that I wouldn't otherwise be friends with. Like, I don't like this. It's fun. Other than the time that I'm on stage, you know, at night, it's weird and lonely and kind of boring. And I want to do something different, you know, with my life. And I want to be home with my partner and my pets. And I just, yeah, I want a different kind of lifestyle than what this is offering.
Mm. It is interesting how it kind of comes down to that in life, you know, like you have to choose the kind of lifestyle that you want to have, you know. Yeah, sure. You can be traveling, running around, doing a bunch of things. I was just talking to my cousin. She was like, I want a more exciting life. And I was like, become a flight attendant. You'd be in 20 cities, you know, you'd be all around. You'll have friends in this city and friends in that city, you know. You'll only be there for 10 minutes, but yeah, you can do it. You know, it's like, some people are like, that's cool. I want to do that. Mm-hmm. And you're right. Yeah. I'm sort of the same way where I was like, I mean, I think it sounds cool, all this, like, doing, like, because I was doing big plays and stuff. And I was, like, just about to get on some tours when I was like, I don't want to do that. I'm not that gal. Like, I'd like to pick a city and then just dig in and know the people and get be part of it and show up to the same thing every Wednesday night and do the same thing. You know, there's something about doing things regularly. And also, I guess maybe it's because I'm older, but like, I like looking into the sort of, like, you know, how things change and ebb and flow. Like, I'm fascinated by the idea of that. Like, even I've lived in Austin, Texas for 10 years, and even just the world, the tiny corner of the world that I populate, has changed so much, you know, like, and I don't even mean in the way any listener of this that's from Austin is like, Austin has changed. You're like, no, I don't mean because they built more buildings or there's more condos. Right. No, no. I mean, like, just my little corner of improv was like a thousand different things over these 10 years. And it's just super fascinating to, like, be there and watch it happen, as opposed to, like, you know, bounce around, do different things, find out about this, find out about that. Facebook is great and all to find out about what your old friends are doing, but it's not, you're not in it. You're not like, oh, I watched that whole thing happen.
Well, and I've exactly, and I've mentored or given advice to, you know, people past my age or starting a new career, you know, at our age and deciding I do want to go after stand up and I'm, you know, in my 40s or my 30s or my 50s. It's like, great. So on one hand, it's never too late to start something new if you're interested in it, and interested is interesting. And I've seen enough, I've known enough and seen enough currently to this day, not just growing up, famous friends or fame adjacent friends, spouses of highly famous people or family members or sisters or brothers, that that's not what brings you happiness. And so I always tell anyone, if they want to shift gears or they want to step back from something or they're curious about what to do next or they're not sure their next move in the career, creative career they're in, is I would say, you know, what do you really want? Do you want, and it's that balance of, do you want adventure? Do you want to meet, do you like meeting lots of new people? Do you might like meeting, you know, being in lots of new places? Do you not want to have a relationship? Do you want to, you know, have a poly relationship? Like, what do you want? Friends and family around you? Do you want to feel loved? Do you want to feel respected? Do you want to feel admired? And, you know, think about what you want to feel. And most of the time, fame isn't the answer to that, but working in the industry and being known and respected in the industry, whether you're famous or not, can answer some of those things. And depending on what kind of creative venture you have and which genre of entertainment industry, live or TV or movies and now everything streaming, or whether you're a crew or a producer or performer, that also impacts what kind of lifestyle you have and what stress levels you have. And I've just gotten to the point where I don't want to have super high stress. And I want to have a stable home life and marriage and relationship. And a really great group of friends and just feel really connected to my community and, you know, have people hopefully respect me and see me as a good performer and a good person. And once I realized that's what I wanted and that didn't necessarily attach to fame and money, then it was like the pressure just, it was just like this huge sigh of relief, like, I can just live my life. I can just do what I want to do. And if fame or fortune follows me, great. And if I watch my friends get fame and fortune because they're doing things the exact same way, great, good for them.
Yeah, totally. I like that you added that last bit because, like, I feel like one of the big things that people are always saying is, like, I'm fine with stuff, good stuff happening to me, but when good stuff happens to other people, I don't like it. I'm like, what? Why? They're like, I get mad, you know, this person, or even because I've been, you know, I'm in my 40s and you hear a lot of, plenty of people are famous. You know what I mean? Like you met them, they went great. You know, I see people on TV and I'm like, oh, look, that's so-and-so great. Like, I'm not like mad. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like what
yeah.
a silly thing to be mad that somebody else happened to get an opportunity. And who knows how they're dealing with it. It could be, like you're saying, it could be exactly what they wanted, or it could turn out to not be exactly what they wanted. And you're sitting there being jealous at them. You don't even know what they're feeling about the whole experience.
Like, yeah, and then suddenly famous people whose shows you love or whose music you love have killed themselves. And you're like, well, guess they weren't enjoying that. So,
yeah.
You know, that's the other side of it is... Shel Silverstein, the poet and artist, had a great quote, and I love to share this quote, which is, I want to be famous someday, but not so famous that somebody wants to kill me. And that's kind of it. I got to give Shel Silverstein credit where credit's due. Like, that's the thing, is like, we think, you know, if you want admiration of your peers, if you want to be respected in your field, if you want to create great, you know, performance or art or music or whatever your medium is, that's its own thing. And just be great at that. I know musicians and related to some that are such better musicians or actors or improvisers than the people who are very, very famous for those things. Because deciding to pursue a career to be famous takes different action items and steps than necessarily being great at your craft. And occasionally those two things align and someone who's really talented and a really great person happens to get the breaks and the opportunities or pursue, you know, a relentless business plan, life plan to get fame. And then they'll turn right around, I'm thinking of Lady Gaga at this exact moment, and say, like, you know what? Fame isn't the thing. Everything else I was doing was the thing, and now I'm famous, but fame isn't the thing that, you know, you think it's going to be.
Yeah.
It doesn't make you happy, and it doesn't give you friends, and it doesn't give you love.
Yeah. Plus, you know, there's a certain amount of, like, it's like when I decided to stop doing, like, theater, doing like plays, it was like, I want to create theater that is of us right now. I don't want to do old plays. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do this guy wrote this in like 1910. Good for him. Like,
right.
No, I want to create things. And, you know, when I personally started doing improv, I found that there was just a stage and, for me to do whatever it was that I wanted to do. And there's no end to the opportunities to do those kinds of things. And when you're deciding what you want to do, I mean, there's certainly, it's the, do you want to do your own words or other people's words? Okay. So then if you want to do other people's words, do you want to do stage plays that you're going to have to do over and over and over? Or do you want to do film, which you'll probably do twice, think you didn't do the right thing, but it's going to be fine anyway. Don't worry about it. Like,
right. We'll fix it in post.
Right. But then there's also the like element of like, think about all of those famous actors. Like there are actors that I know who like, you know, have gotten caught in a contract where it's like, okay, well now I have to do five movies that are like this. And that means that I can't do anything else I'm interested in. And I can't be involved with anything else. Like, it's just really, like, you have to consider everything about what you want out of life. You know, if you're
exactly
in a way that's like, I feel like we're putting more on the shoulders of new theater people than we really have to. But at the same time, like, it's good to know whether you're like, because if you're fine with people telling you what to do, get in there. Do it. They're happy to tell you what to do. Like, I'm not a girl who can handle other people telling me what to do that well. I mean, I act and it's fine and it's all funsies, but like 90% of what I do is I'm in charge of. And then there's that 10% where it's like, ooh, I'm being directed. It's so novel. Like, you know, but if my whole life, I mean, if I were Brad Pitt, how many like real decisions is he making? Like, really?
Right.
Especially the millions that he gets, you know, there's got to be an agent who's like, you're doing this movie. Like, we all need to pay our mortgages, so you're doing this movie. Like, you know, it's crazy. The plus the like level of what they put upon them, like as an you know, where it's like, we expect you to be amazing. Like, Beyonce had twins and then they were like, why isn't she touring? I don't understand. And you're like, could the girl have a nap? Like, good Lord.
Why is she so, why is she curvy again? Ooh, she's quote unquote fat. Like, she just had babies and her body is doing what her body needs to do. And also, none of your doll danged business, bitches, back off. Like, And that's the thing. It's like, do you want to be under that much scrutiny? You know, do you want to be constantly criticized? Do you want to have constant rejection? Or do you want to have like occasional criticism and rejection or occasional feedback or, you know, or craft something in a real way versus some, you know, some agent or manager or weird, you know, current industry vision, which changes all the time, of what you're supposed to look like and how you're supposed to be. And I think that's the part of Hollywood fame that I've definitely, you know, stepped as far away from as I possibly can, is that idea of like, you have to like be a certain weight and do a certain thing and look a certain way. And then that all that constantly changes. So the people who are physically and emotionally and mentally trying to keep up with all of that, like it feels like a losing game. And eventually it is, because whoever is super duper famous at some point is not going to be super duper famous and is still going to have to try to have a living.
Yeah. Yeah, and they still have to feel cool with whatever they've put out in the world. They're still artists like the rest of us. They're not like, you know, none of the people who are currently famous for doing art don't like art. You know what I mean? Like, they're not like, ugh, God, do I have to write another hit song? Like, Taylor Swift's not like, man, I hate performing. Like, no, of course she loves it.
Nope.
But, like, she, as an example, has been redefining what it is to be a performer forever and ever and ever. So
and she's also just taken a huge, if you read this, but she's taken a huge risk, kind of exposing some shady back deal things that she was subjected to and tried to pressure and was people were trying to pressure her into. And she's like, nope, I know they don't want me to talk about it and they say it's going to hurt my career, but I have to tell you all this shady, shady shit that's going on and you all need to know about it.
Yeah.
And she did. And you know what? She's still Taylor Swift and people are still downloading her album like crazy. So there you go, girl.
Absolutely.
Take back the power.
Yeah, she's definitely got the power in that situation, which is really great. And maybe she likes being famous. I mean, she's certainly done well with the power she has. So perhaps she enjoys it and has found a way to like make it exactly what everyone would like, which is get something good for me and I help the world. Seems like a solid win-win.
Yeah. Yeah. And the people that I admire the most who are at that level of fame, whether we've known them and friends of the family or current friends or not, are people who understand that they get to a place of power to share that power or to use that power and privilege for the betterment of not just their own community of actors and, you know, acting rights and, you know, be in the WGA or the DGA to get better terms for voiceover actors or the union or stunt people, but then, you know, extra philanthropy out in the world. And then you also watch people who get to that level of fame and you're watching them lose their mind in real time. You're watching their anxieties take over. You're watching them make ridiculously bad decisions and you think, oh, that doesn't look like fun at all. But I think it's absolutely possible to enjoy fame. And I do have, you know, some friends who do it, but it can be a stress. And there's a lot that when you get to that level that is no longer in your control creatively in order to get to that level. And that's, again, part of that, you know, quality of life balance that, you know, you need to think about or at least understand exists when you're, you know, going for the gold or moving, you know, friends who moved to LA and then moved back a year later, like, ooh, that was horrible. It's like, yeah, I kind of tried to warn you, and I'm happy to introduce you to friends I know down there who actually are nice people who won't use you and abuse you, but it's a tough scene. You know, it's really, it'll grind you out if you're not ready for it, but it keeps happening. So,
yeah, it's nice that you're like there for your friends in that way, you know, like that you're able to help them in a way that, you know, they need.
Yeah. And again, I'm not going to dissuade somebody from making that decision or, you know, taking that leap of faith in themselves. But I'm also going to be brutally honest from a lifetime and, you know, again, third generation of knowing exactly what really, really happens behind the scenes. So anything that's come out about, you know, Weinstein and Me Too, like that was stuff that I knew was going on when I was five. That's what I saw other child actors. Unfortunately, I wasn't in that context, but, you know, I saw other child actors physically, sexually, emotionally abused all the time. It just, you knew it was there. That's something you know is happening. And, you know, the joke when I had the tantrum, I was at age whatever, 7 or 8, was I made the joke later on in stand-up that, yeah, I got out of being a child actor, you know, before I had to go into rehab. And it's true, because that kind of trauma that occurs at that, for my peers at that age, like they have clearly gone way off the rails in the rest of their life with trauma and addiction and things that stemmed from that exact time period, even if they're, especially if they're super famous for it.
Yeah. Man.
But
deep topics.
But dream your dreams, we're getting, everybody.
We're getting
dream
that.
Your dreams.
Now, hey, you know.
Dream your dreams.
You know,
go,
it's funny.
Go for it. It's fine.
You're talking about how you knew this kind of stuff. I am the opposite. I'm like so naive. Like when things happen, I'm like, oh, what? People aren't nice to each other just inherently?
Yeah.
I don't understand. I mean, like, I don't know how I got to be such a Pollyanna, but it turns out that's what's happening. Like, really insane. But you know, I mean, I think it's important for people to, you know, go in with open eyes. You know, you have to be aware that there's going to be some tough stuff, and, you know, hopefully it's something you can handle. But if it isn't, then, you know, good that you know now, you know?
And it's important to know about, you know, those minefields or those pitfalls or the toxicity of, you know, pervasive toxicity and abuse of culture behind the scenes, so that you also can, like, know to avoid it and to not necessarily trust people unless they're, like, genuinely good people, or to do things like I try to set up, which is, hey, here are some names of people I know who I know are good people and will not, you know, turn you out or abuse you or take advantage of you, and, you know, give this a try. But, you know, go somewhere into a new scene with friends or references or, you know, anything else that's a buoy of trust that you can latch onto and know that it's real. Because when you just come in, you know, straight off the bus from Tulsa or wherever, and you're just plopped onto Hollywood Boulevard, yeah, you are going to be like spit up and chewed out, because you don't know who's who.
Yeah.
Good times.
So we've talked a lot about advice for other people and what they're doing. But one final thing before I let you go is I want to ask, what is the thing that you personally in your own creative life, I like to say, like, what's your jam? Like, what's the thing that you're sort of working on? And when I teach level one class, so I teach the same class over and over and over and over and over. So for me, it becomes different by, you know, based on whatever thing I'm thinking about. You know, sometimes I'm obsessed with characters, and sometimes I'm obsessed with, you know, collaborating and like how it's all, there are no mistakes and those kinds of things, depending upon wherever I am in my own sort of like mind journey of improv at the time when I teach, it comes out. Now, I don't, you're leading musical improv troupes and working with other groups. I'm sure you also work on your own creative stuff. What's the, like, idea or thing that's been rolling around in your head recently that you've become interested in that you're exploring?
Well, it's actually an idea that I started having and did to a certain extent about 15 years ago, and I've been really wanting to see and create and get off the ground, and I finally did over the summer. And so I'm very interested in, not just because I do improv and I play a lot of musical instruments and I do improv accompaniment, which is rare enough in itself for someone who does accompaniment and the onstage improv of it. I'm a pretty rare unicorn. There's a few of us out there, but it's pretty rare. It's usually more one or the other. Is I am super interested in doing very modern music with a full band improv. And it's already occurring. It's not like this is a brand new idea, but I've been developing that more and more and more with some of my colleagues in the Bay Area. I just did a couple months run of a new format at Unscripted Theater Company in San Francisco called Mixtape. It ran in September into early October, where it's a keyboard player with some computerized beats, myself with my keyboard with some computerized beats and patches, and me on guitar and trumpet and harmonicas or anything else that we need. And we're making up a mixtape with a cast of six people for an hour of completely new songs, completely full band songs. You don't have a drummer, but we have instantly programmed electronic drums. And just getting that beautiful psychic moment together between the other keyboard player and myself, of like the two of us are coordinating this, and we're mixing and creating electronic and live music at the same time. The singers are making up lyrics and harmonies at the same time, and it's all very, very modern music. It's not only it's not primarily that kind of Broadway style or musical theater style that we're used to. Musical improv is, if someone's, you know, if the year that we're set in, we would do the ask is, what's the year you were a teenager? So if someone was a teen, said 2012, and they're still a relatively young person, great. Then we have songs that sound like Taylor Swift, that sound like Pink, that sound like Maroon 5, that sound like that year, that decade, or anything earlier that can occur. And that's what I'm super interested in right now, is what is this cutting edge of creating musical improv with more than one accompanist in a way that is really new and interesting and fresh and relatable to today's, you know, kind of cynical audiences. So that's been my thing, is how can I keep doing stuff like that?
I love the mixtape idea. It's really amazing. It sounds so cool. I did a musical improv thing myself, and I totally know what you mean about that, you know, the total jam when everyone's coming together and then you're like making real songs, and it's like, I can't believe we're doing this. This is really happening. Like, it's amazing in a way that is, it's another level. I love improv. I love, you know, talking, acting improv, and that's great. But God, musical improv, when it works well, is like another level of magic. Oh.
Yeah. And there's buddies of mine that I now know are good friends and play with them if I'm in LA, and they come up and play in San Francisco and play with them. That's an live improv rock band, and they're called Surprise Inside. And so I featured them in festival I produce here with Unscripted, West Coast Musical Improv Festival. We first featured them, that was 4 or 5 years ago when we started the festival, as a way to close, like a closing jam with a full band where the entire band is improvising. So I sit in with them as much as I can, you know, back and forth to LA or up here. And it's so much, each element of a new musician or new person that you add to a group that's completely improvising music makes it 10 times more complicated than when it's an accompanist by itself. And it's already so impressive when it's just a guitarist or a keyboardist and a bunch of people making up songs. But when you add each other musician that you add into it, each new instrument just, you know, squares it by many, many factors. And when it works, it's exquisite. It's like absolutely existential when all of that works together and you're just all in the vibe. Fantastic.
Man. So cool. Well, listen, thank you so much for sharing your stories with me and your advice. You have a very unique point of view when it comes to a life in theater and performing and entertainment. And I really appreciate you sharing all of your wisdom from that experience that you've had.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Amy. It's absolutely my pleasure to talk to you. Whether we're being recorded for a podcast or not, I've really enjoyed the conversation. And again, hopefully other people tune in and listen and can take a little piece of what we've talked about and, you know, make it improve their lives too.
Here's hoping.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.